Okay, we're going to get started. Excuse our backs, everyone, but we're going to be doing slides today, so they've switched it up and put the council over here so we can see what's up above us. We're going to work our way through some issues and questions from our hearings, begin identifying possible amendments that we'll be taking up at later council sessions. So we get Susan and Eric to reground us in where we are in the process, what's ahead, and what some of the, maybe walk through a whole list of issues that we, again, heard a lot about in the hearings. I've still got my stack of issues that I'm talking with the staff about, so appreciate the opportunity to do this together, and I'll let you three take it away.
Thank you. Morning, Mayor, Council. So with me this morning, Eric Engstrom and Marty Sockton, and also Joe Zender, Gary Manning, John Cole, and several other folks that are here to answer questions as need be, and many folks from the community who also have an interest in this. So as you remember, we've had a really busy summer and fall working on planning issues, and we appreciate all the time and effort that your staff has put into this and your involvement and their tenacity, really. In August, the Planning and Sustainability Commission gave you its recommendation on zoning code and other implementation elements. Then in September, we sat around this table and we provided you some very in-depth briefings on seven different elements. We talked about the new mixed-use zones, new zones for colleges and hospitals, code and map changes related to employment goals. We talked about revisions to residential zoning, improvements to our community involvement program, a revised major public trails map, and phase two of the transportation system plan. In October, you held hearings and collected a lot of written testimony on all the proposed changes and a lot of oral testimony during those hearings. There were more than 800 comments. Many of those comments were clustered around just a few very specific issues. We've grouped those together, and today we're going to go over those key issues. We've done a lot of this with your staff already, so hopefully some of this is familiar to you. The hope is that you can more thoroughly understand the issues and then be able to put together any amendments that you deem appropriate, and I know you already have a few lined up. After the session in November, we'll bring your amendments back for a public hearing, and then in December, hopefully, you'll have one more opportunity to discuss and have a final vote before the end of the year. So again, appreciate your staff's time and all of this and all of your time. Some of you have really dug into this, and I really appreciate that. If there's not any more questions about what we're going to do, I'll turn it over to Eric. He will walk through the agenda. And you'll notice that Marty's at the table also, and Deborah Stein, now that she's retired. Marty has been, at least in the interim now, we haven't hired a new position, but she's been, especially on this project, stepped up and been doing a great job at pulling together a lot of the community information and the work of the district liaisons. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm just going to go through the intent of the agenda this morning and cover a few housekeeping issues. So as Susan mentioned, we have an agenda this morning that's designed to cover some of the issues that have come up in testimony. We've met with your staff over the past week to get a sense of what your interests are, and we've roughly proportioned the agenda to correspond with the weight of those concerns in different areas. The major segments of the agenda today are first to deal with some zoning code questions, then go into the zoning map, community involvement program, transportation system plan, phase two questions, and major public trails. And within each of those segments, there's a couple things that we'll try and give you more detail on. And then there's also time for you to ask questions. We're hoping that this will help us arrive at, we've asked each council office to send us a list of possible amendments by the end of this week, if possible, and that will allow us to, we hope, by the end of next week, get something out publicly with the list of what's on the table for amendments. We've scheduled a hearing on November 17th to discuss those. We are available, of course, between now and next week to help confirm the list that each of you has for consideration, give advice on potential code language, and help with confirming properties that might be subject to a map change. We would like to get out a courtesy notice to property owners that are affected by any map changes the following week, so they have a little advance notice of that hearing. So that's also why we're trying to move this list-making process along.
And does that include upzonings as well as downzoning, the notice to property?
Either way, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's great.
And a few process details. You heard from about 90 people in person in the two hearings, but don't forget, as Susan mentioned, there's a few hundred more comments that came in through the email and the online map app, and we've delivered the fourth of our bundles of those letters and emails to you yesterday, so your offices should have that, and we've provided a copy to the council clerk, so those are in the record. If you've got any lingering letters from that period before the record closed, which was the 17th at 8 a.m., if you have any lingering letters from that period that you haven't yet forwarded to us, please do that so we can make sure that that's in the record. A reminder that the record did close on the 17th, so you shouldn't be considering new letters that are coming in right now, but we will have an opportunity for the public to weigh in on the 17th, and once we release that list of amendments, that'll be a new open period for comment. Among the 800 comments, a couple of the themes that stood out when we were reading through the testimony, you continue to get a lot of testimony from Multnomah Village concerned about CM2 zoning. There were quite a few letters, over 75, about parking. There were quite a few letters about the Alphabet District, both pro and con on the issue of the floor area ratios. Drive-through code, a lot of different perspectives on that. Again, kind of both pro and con. Trails testimony, mostly from impacted property owners, but there's a few particular sites I think we'll talk about today. Most colleges and hospitals have now weighed in with their formal letter and a couple other letters from their legal counsel on details. You got a whole bunch of letters supporting OS zoning on the Green Thumb site in Brentwood, Darlington, and that's an affirmative testimony about in favor of something that's in the proposal, so that doesn't need an amendment. And, of course, a whole bunch of letters from individual property owners scattered all over the city. And finally, a reminder that this package is intended to implement the recently adopted comp plan. Some of what you heard in the testimony may prompt you to revisit discussions that were made in June when you adopted the plan. If any of your amendments do have that effect of reopening a comp plan decision that you made in June, we'll try and flag that as staff so that you're aware of when that's coming up. Our direction or our suggestion on that is that we flag those and that we put those on a separate list with a directive from you as part of our adoption ordinance for us to come back in early 2018 with a recommendation on those things. And the logic there is to separate that out into a separate action so that we're not reopening periodic review with the state process, that we treat those as post-acknowledgement amendments if there's any revisiting to individual sites that we want to explore over the next year. And again, we're suggesting that because we're anxious to finish the state process so that our hands are not so tied with that process and the what we have to do there. So with that, I think we're ready to move into the substance, unless there are any process questions. Okay. The first topic was to look at zoning code questions, and we've highlighted a couple issues that we want to go into a little bit more depth on in the first part of the agenda. Mixed-use design, drive-through codes, the Alphabet District, parking, and then a few other miscellaneous. So starting with the mixed-use design, we have a PowerPoint slide that we can bring up. And I want to just start by briefly reminding you what was changed, and I've asked Barry Manning to join us for this part of the discussion. He was the project manager for the mixed-use zoning project. Start off with a brief reminder of what the mixed-use code amendments have done with the PSC's recommendation. If you want to move on to the first slide there. The current mixed-use, commercial mixed-use codes are fairly unnuanced in terms of design and massing of buildings. They pretty much allow a box of a particular height with setbacks. So that drawing is intended to portray that. housing is not included in the floor area ratios. It's just subject to height and setbacks. The proposed scheme that the Planning Commission recommended on the next slide is has a couple modifications to that. The most important one is that floor area is now counted in and is part of that, so there's more certainty about the massing of buildings. We've also introduced a couple different design standards, required outdoor space for residential uses, limit on building length facade of the length of building facades, more aggressive active ground floor use requirements in some portions of the city, larger ground floor window requirements, and then step downs on the back of the building, modeled after what's already in place on Division Street, but more applicable to other streets that don't yet have that, where the back section of the building has to get closer to the residential height limits.
I have a question about the required outdoor area. Very happy to see it. Mm-hmm. It's in green. Is it required to be either an eco roof or something? Is there any requirement for some vegetation in it?
There are landscaping requirements as a separate element of the code. The outdoor area does not require green. It could be met through interior space, community rooms in the building, or shared plazas or balconies. And so there's a mix and match menu essentially that qualifies you, but there are landscaping and green standards that we've also modified that allow a menu of choices between a green roof, the traditional landscaping standard approach, or there's also an option that allows you a little less landscaping if you make that the shape of the area bigger and plant a large canopy tree. So there's a menu essentially.
And is this going to be carried over to the multifamily dwelling rules?
That's the intent, but we'll see how that project plays out. And multifamily does already have open space requirements.
This applies to the mixed use zones. Just had a fragmentary memory, and I want to double check it. These requirements don't apply to the CX downtown zones, right?
Right. Everything we're talking about here is non-central city, so it's outside the central city plan district. Yeah.
So the fragment I remember, and I hope it's still not true, is that we had a requirement for extra setbacks in the South Auditorium district, left over from very early
days. That would be a central city question, and
yeah,
I'm not sure I know the answer.
Research that. I'm not sure if we're now focusing in general more on design and articulation. It may be an artifact to have a setback requirement as a way to get to pedestrian friendliness.
The way this is handled in the central city is there is design review without the second track, so that you're usually in discretionary design review in the central city plan district.
Yeah.
Moving on to the next slide. The other significant change is the introduction of a base and bonus idea, where you have a base floor area allowance and then a bonus, which is achievable by meeting a certain collection of public goods. And right now we've primarily defined public goods as affordable commercial and affordable residential space, so parallel programs based on affordability, with the bulk of that bonus being only earnable through the affordable housing. With the inclusionary housing program, in effect what happens is that projects that are required to meet that program would automatically get this bonus floor area.
Can I ask two questions? First, I think we're all pretty conversant in what affordable housing means, but how do we define affordable commercial space in this?
We've been working with PDC on that question, and it's similar. We do not currently have a program like that, but it's similar in principle, where we define a percentage below the area rent, and it's a little trickier because in commercial space you don't have a citywide data on median rent for commercial spaces that's collected in quite the same way. So that's a aspect of that program that we're still working on with PDC.
We can. Why don't we write that up, send it to you, and then if you have more questions about it, you can get into the detail.
No, thank you. And let me plant a flag on a related issue, which is I'm going to kick off at some point soon a work group looking at affordable art space. And it's something PDC cares about. It's something that RAC cares about. And we're displacing artists, nonprofit arts organizations, and other things. And there are lots of cities that are ahead of us here, including doing up-to-date inventories, thinking about using both incentives and other tools. Sometimes it's just as simple as cutting red tape. In other instances, it's fine-tuning programs. We have, Mayor, we have a huge opportunity here with the purchase of the two lots in the Central East Side to look at affordable makerspace. So as we flush out what affordable commercial space means, I'd like to see whether we can introduce into that definition art space, and that would include creating incentive to have a nonprofit arts organization or something in the building, and see whether that is consonant with what you're trying to get at.
Essentially, what PDC is doing is building on their existing program that they use within urban renewal areas. An example of that is in Lentz, where they're involved with the construction of a number of new buildings right now that will have ground floor space, and one of their roles is to curate and lease up those ground floor spaces, and they have criteria for how to get to a community benefit as they do that. And the idea with this bonus is to essentially allow that kind of process with their involvement outside of the urban renewal districts in exchange for a bonus. They would be involved in managing the eligibility and the requirements for what is affordable and the leasing requirements and the covenant requirements.
Before you move on too much, if you wouldn't mind, go back a slide. So in the earlier slide that showed the outdoor space and this one, the outdoor space shrank by more than half. I assume that's just an accident of the drawings and that the outdoor space requirement doesn't diminish when one implements the bonus.
Correct. We just happen to show it that way.
Okay.
You know, presumably maybe they're doing an indoor community room in the bigger building, but we just happen to show
it
that way.
We don't give up outdoor space in exchange for meeting the bonus requirements. The bonus requirements are layered with that.
Yes.
Okay. And jumping back a further slide, I just wanted to raise a concern PBOT has about the facade articulation requirements. The Planning and Sustainability Commission had an amendment that said that the way the standard would work would require buildings to have a certain percentage of square footage of the outside wall to jet out or press into the side of the building. And the PSC amendment was to allow windows that jet out into the right-of-way to count towards meeting the standard. And PBOT is concerned about that because it puts more pressure on scarce right-of-way and normally, I mean, sort of outside of the normal way we treat the right-of-way, so we might see something on that.
This slide is a basic overview of the palette of the mixed-use zones that have been recommended, ranging from the smallest CR zone to the largest CM3. And as you can see, it's a range of allowed floor areas and height limits that kind of go from small to big. And there are two rows there below the pictures. One is the base, and then the other is the bonus. So particularly, for example, the CM2 is where is the most common of these zones, which is kind of replacing the CS zone. And you can see that it has 45 feet and 2.5:1 at a base, and then it has 55 feet with 4:1 as the achievable bonus. And again, that would be what would be allowed for those that are under the inclusionary housing program. With an additional footnote at the bottom that there's an extra 5 feet that could be earned if the ground floor has high ceilings, and that was something the Planning Commission recommended be added to encourage good design of retail space. And so I want to just mention one more thing and then ask Barry to just walk us through quickly those issues. I'm going to skip ahead a few slides to the bonus in historic districts. And maybe just go to the map. One feature that you need to resolve is right now the way the Planning Commission recommendation is that the bonuses would not be allowed in historic districts in the mixed-use zones. And so that's a question that needs to be resolved because it is potentially in conflict with our affordable housing program goal. And I think their recommendation has been to allow them in historic districts. So that's a place where we need some council deliberation. But to step back to the, let's start off with the additional building height slide. And Barry, maybe if you could say a little bit about what that's about.
Sure. Barry Manning, planning staff. as part of the whole mixed-use zoning development process, we had several conversations with developers, architects, community about how we might best achieve some of the goals in the project. And one of the things that came out early on was this notion that really high-quality retail space requires higher ceilings at the ground floor than our current code allows for in a reasonable manner. And so there was a desire to actually provide a little bit more flexibility at the ground floor to allow for that high ceiling retail space at the ground floor. And as the project evolved, the question of parking became another issue that looked to the ground floor to be more flexible to allow for parking stackers, mechanized parking stackers, which is a new technology that's coming on board. So the Planning Commission ultimately asked us to look at that more closely and ended up recommending an additional 5 foot of height flexibility that could be applied over the entire building when the ground floor of these new mixed-use buildings has a minimum ceiling height of 15 feet from the floor to the ceiling to allow for that high ceiling ground floor retail or for those mechanized parking stackers. So that was the outcome of that. Initially applied in a smaller area, but Planning Sustainability Commission, ultimately recommended to apply it citywide to allow for that flexibility. And then the parapets and roof railings, since we're anticipating to see more open area usable by residents, some of that's going to be met through rooftop spaces. We also had community conversations about a desire for more roofline variety. So the proposal allows for 3.5 feet of additional height for railings and parapets that could extend beyond the normal height limits in these areas.
Let's move on then to the step backs. The other feature that the Plan Commission discussed was this example applies in the CM2 zone where the standard height is 45 feet and then it jumps up to 55 with the bonus. And the original staff recommendation was that fifth story, when it's applied in those situations, be stepped back from the street. And this is on the opposite side of the step down for the residential facing portion of the building. The Planning Commission had quite a discussion about the pros and cons of that in terms of cost of construction and what that does to urban design. And so, Barry, if you want to mention anything more about that.
Maybe before we move on, Eric, I do want to clarify that in the CM2 zone, the height limit with the bonus is 55 feet plus the 5 feet of flexible space. But that 55 feet is only available in areas designated as mixed-use urban centers, so our inner ring neighborhoods and our civic corridors, the areas where we expect to have the most intensity and development in the long term. In the areas that are designated in the comp plan as mixed-use neighborhood, and those are places like Selwood or Multnomah Village, that additional 10 feet is not available in those areas, being mindful of the scale of the existing development in their area and the smaller scale that the neighborhood designation applies. So I just want to make that clear before I describe the step back.
So how much is the height in Multnomah Village, Selwood, places like that?
It would be 45 as the base height with the 5 feet of flexibility for the ground floor. So it could be 45 to 50 ultimately in those areas, but not going up to the 55 in those areas. Yeah.
So the highest you could get if you were using both all the bonuses and you had high ground floor and you were in the urban center area, you could get up to 60.
I'm confused a little bit as to why we're having bonuses for things other than affordable housing. I thought that we had made a decision that we were really going to focus on pushing for affordable housing rather than high ground floor or whatever.
This was an addition the Planning Commission recommended based on design concerns about the quality of that space. And also, as Barry mentioned, the increasing use of parking stackers requires a 20-foot clear on that ground floor space, and so this is another way to encourage that, too.
The other point is just that the housing, you have to do affordable housing first. You can't get the other bonuses unless you do affordable housing, so it's not
in competition.
It's not sneaking in front of it. It's saying affordable housing first.
And do we have any buildings that have the parking stackers now?
We do, yeah.
Where?
I'd have to show you. I'd have to go back and look for some examples, and I'd be happy
That'd
to
be
follow
very
up with that.
That'd be very interesting. Thank you.
Mark, you've been stuck.
Yeah, there's probably over a dozen at this point. The one that I'm most familiar with is a few blocks from my house on Williams. It's across the street from the Peloton. That building has
has a double set of mechanical stackers. And that does, reduce the cost of parking a little bit, so that's why people are using it. Do you want to add anything more about the step back, Barry?
Yeah, just a little background on those. You know, in our community conversations about height and scale, as was evidenced in the testimony, there's lots of discussion about what the appropriate height on the main streets are. Again, we tried to stick fairly close to the existing height limits. The 45 is the existing height limit in the CS zone and is pretty prevalent around town. The bonus height of 55 feet, again, would be applied only in the mixed-use urban center and the mixed-use civic corridor in a bonus situation for affordable housing. The step back, the question there was whether or not that fifth story, when it was applied, should be at the street wall or whether it should be recessed a little bit to kind of maintain that four-story street wall. And I don't know if you've got, or if you can go back one slide or two slides, Marty, but we just simulated, this is a illustration of Division Street. And the step back in that case, because Division Street isn't a mixed-use urban center, staff's original proposal was to set back that top floor, that top fifth floor, from the street wall to maintain that four-story maximum street wall line in there, rather than going to five straight up. And the next slide shows a couple of buildings that have that kind of stepped back top floor. So that was the original staff proposal. And again, Planning and Sustainability Commission debated this pretty vigorously and ultimately decided that the additional costs associated with the construction of that stepped back and the loss of the floor area and development potential kind of outweighed the benefit of the urban design side of things, and ultimately decided to not step back those bonus floors for the CM3 zones.
But it's important to note that the step back, if it's next to single-family residential or on the back of the property, is still required. And so what was happening was you might have on both sides going like little top hat,
right,
is what would be required. And there was just a lot of discussion, including in bringing in, data around penciling out how this would work from a financial point of view, and it just became a point of, well, we wouldn't do that top story at all. And so there was a trade-off, so I think you should think about that same discussion about, is it worth it? And we're happy to bring in some pro forma kind of, information if you want to look at that.
And this still would, the proposal does still maintain the step downs in the rear, as yeah. Susan mentioned. We did also, in our early modeling, look at side of building step backs as well, and so we ended up with a lot of pyramid type models, and we decided not to go in that direction.
Moving on to address the issue you raised, Commissioner Novick.
I apologize for not looking ahead and seeing it was addressed directly.
It's okay. We put this on there because we knew that you would have that question. The standard that is basically the facade articulation standard. That's one of the recommended design standards, and it is triggered when you have a facade plane that's larger than a certain size, and it allows you a couple options to meet it. But you basically have to recess or change the plane of a certain percentage of that larger plane. And originally, the way we wrote it was you could recess or use oriel windows, but the oriel windows out over the right-of-way wouldn't count, that it was mostly a backward step as opposed to a frontward. The Planning Commission had concerns about the impact on development and wanted to provide more development capacity, and so they recommended that oriel windows out over the right-of-way would count for that standard. So that's just a slightly different twist on the standard.
So on that, though, we have had projects come to council and had a lot of discussion about do they get to project over by right or not. So is there a blanket, now we don't care if people...
That was PBOT's concern, that this standard, if it says that this counts, that it would increase the pressure for us to approve those oriel windows, and that was their objection. The standard itself doesn't authorize it, so you'd still have to have that PBOT authorization. But it does potentially lead to more pressure for those kind of applications. So it's a trade-off. The Planning Commission wanted it because they felt like that the extra floor area that would be gained by that would be helpful, but that's a that's a trade-off.
Does that apply on the ground floor as well as the upper floors, or just the upper floors?
You could articulate on the ground floor and meet your requirement in that manner. So you could step back, for instance, your ground floor and meet that 25% articulation requirement.
Doubt on the ground floor. Oh, that's what I'm saying.
I don't believe so.
No, the oriel window requirements are specifically for up above. So yeah, that you don't get to. I mean, there is a way to ask for an encroachment permit, but that's different.
Skinny down the sidewalk space, the public space. It only is,
no, and in fact, it
a story up really and higher.
Yeah, this in combination with the building length requirement does encourage more use of occasional plazas that dip into the development from the sidewalk. So it's intended to create those kind of spaces, which have been popular where they've been provided. And there's some pictures, I think.
I think the next two slides show some examples of the type of outcomes we thought we might see. Those buildings there are articulating at about 25% or more level. Examples from Sellwood as well as MLK. So different examples around town that are existing. Our thought was with the new floor area ratios and the height limits in combination that articulation would be possible. Stepping back, so that was the original staff proposal again on that, and again changed by Planning and Sustainability Commission to allow the projections to count. On the next slide, I just wanted to show you some examples of buildings that would probably be exempt from the articulation requirement. As Eric mentioned earlier, there's a threshold that you have to hit to trigger the articulation requirement. You have to have a pretty big facade plane area to really kick into that.
It's poignant that you chose one of the buildings that was damaged in the explosion.
Yeah.
That's Brad Kofol's masterpiece.
We had the slide before that.
And I assume when they rebuild it, it doesn't trigger any new code, right?
I think it depends on when they pull their permits as to what code would be applied. But
so even the building in the upper right-hand corner is smaller, but it's smaller. Yeah. Yeah.
And the reason for that, I believe in the upper right-hand corner, that would be what would be our new CM3 zone, and buildings that are under four stories and under 100 feet in length, and that may be just about 100 feet in length, wouldn't trigger that. So this would be close, I would say. But the bottom example, for instance, is above that four-story limit, but the facade planes are broken up by a entryway between the buildings that kind of meets a minimum requirement.
So that's our overview of some of the issues that I think you heard most about in testimony related to the mixed-use design. I want to just ask if there are any questions or follow-up concerns. Okay.
They all want to get to drive-through.
Yeah, so. Okay. So the next topic is the drive-through conversation, which also had a lot of testimony. Just to start that conversation off, just a note, from a code point of view, a drive-through is a facility that is part of development. It's not technically a use in the way we define uses in the code, but it's a type of development. And then another terminology that is useful in this conversation is a term called quick vehicle servicing, which is a type of commercial use. And that sometimes is conflated or mixed up in this conversation because quick vehicle servicing uses inherently involve a drive-through, because if you think about examples like a Jiffy Lube or a oil change or a car wash or a gas station, those are by definition including drive-throughs typically. So that's the gas stations and quick vehicle servicing is caught up in this larger conversation about drive-throughs, unless we uncouple it, which is one of the discussions we may have.
And the proposal is currently to keep it together? Or
well, we'll go over some options in a minute. But historically, we have linked those in the code. I think what we want to do is walk through three options with an accompanying map about where they will be allowed and not allowed. And option A is the PSC recommendation, just for us to describe what they recommended. Option B is what the original staff recommendation was before the PSC changes. And then option C, we've done some brainstorming about what else could you do on this issue to address some of the testimony we got. And so we have a third option that is not necessarily a proposal yet, but it's a way of thinking about how could we do it differently. So we'll walk through each of those. And Barry, maybe if you could do that.
Sure. Got to see what slide we've got up. So option A, again, is the Planning Sustainability Commission recommendation. This option would allow drive-thrus in the CE zone, which is our commercial employment zone, which is typically thought to be the more auto-accommodating zone, would replace our existing general commercial zone in most areas. It would prohibit new drive-thrus in the CR, which is the very small-scale commercial residential zone, as well as CM1 through CM3, and CX as well, which is applied primarily in the central city. And it would also prohibit them in the center's Main Street overlay zone. And if you'll recall, we had some areas within our designated centers where we're applying a new overlay that really is trying to promote pedestrian-oriented activity, active ground floor uses, and things of that nature. So it would prohibit them there. It would allow rebuilding of existing drive-thrus in CM1, CM2, and CM3, except in that center's Main Street overlay zone and where they're prohibited by existing plan districts, for instance. And the thought behind that was that, in our zoning change in this new palette that's being applied, some of areas that might currently allow for a drive-through facility, maybe the CN2 zone or some other areas of existing CG zone, would be changing or converting to a CM zone. So we wanted to make sure that, or in the staff proposal and Planning Commission's recommendation, we wanted to ensure that folks would have the ability to rebuild and have a little bit more flexibility to redevelop with the drive-through if they had one already, rather than making them non-conforming and presenting those challenges for upgrading non-conforming development. But the one thing that the Planning Sustainability Commission option A did that was a significant departure from staff's original proposal is that it prohibited new or rebuilding of drive-through facilities east of Northeast Southeast 80th. So the map on the next slide kind of shows how that plays out, and hopefully those colors are clear enough, but the red represents areas where drive-throughs would just be strictly prohibited. And you can see on that map that everything east of about 80th Avenue, it's all red. Nothing could be developed new, nor could they be rebuilt in that more flexible provision east of 80th. They would still have their right to change their development as non-conforming situations, but that's a little bit more constrained. West of 80th, the development regulations would allow drive-thrus again in the areas that are shown green on that map. That's the CE zone, and that would be just allowed outright. The areas red, again, are primarily corresponding to the Main Street overlay zone areas. So if you look at, for instance, the inner southeast Main Streets, there's little bits of red there. And the orange areas represent areas where you would have that flexibility to rebuild an existing drive-through, but you couldn't develop a new one. So that's the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommendation.
Option. Of course, the green is where they would be allowed.
And green, again, is where they would be just allowed outright.
So can I ask, what is the underlying philosophical driver for the ban east of 80th? I know I'm asking you to characterize the Planning Sustainability Commission. But
sure, I understand. And I will do the best I can on that, and Eric, jump in as well on that. I think there was a concern that there had been a lot of discussion that the development market was not quite ready for more intense mixed-use development east of 80th Avenue. A lot of discussion about that, and that developments with drive-thrus and or auto-oriented uses were likely to be the prevalent development type in the near-term planning future. And there was a concern, I think, that by allowing that to happen in the near-term planning future, that we would be precluding opportunities for more intense mixed-use development as we near the end of that planning term. So precluding those opportunities and locking up sites for that kind of development when there might be some opportunities later on as the market kind of changed for mixed-use development.
There was also an argument, sort of a community development argument made by folks in East Portland that of more self-determination, that in their view, a lot of the drive-thrus were chain businesses that were not necessarily locally owned, and they felt that there was a potential opening if drive-thrus are restricted, it may open up that territory to more locally driven community development efforts. The industry said, well, the risk of this is that you're going to have vacant sites for a while because mixed use isn't financially viable yet. And the community responded saying, well, we see that as an opportunity, not a threat. So there was it was that community development argument.
Is there, it struck me as curious to have more restrictions east of 80th than west of 80th. And my understanding is that one of the reasons for that is that there's more, if you're going to allow them in the CE zone, that there's more CE zone east of 80th, and therefore there's more potential for a proliferation of drive-thrus than in west of 80th when there's less CE zone.
Right, and then maybe that's a bridge to the next map. The option B, if you show the map related to option B, Barry, this before they did that amendment, essentially there would have been more green areas in East Portland than any other quadrant of the city. So I think there was a concern that the result of the staff's proposal would be to focus that kind of development in East Portland.
What there is, I mean, I assume there's no simple way to sort of equalize things and take some. Okay.
Yeah, so well, option C was partly a reaction to the 80th Avenue question. Option B, just very briefly, because I don't think we need to go into too much detail there, but it's similar. It's just lacking that blanket prohibition east of 80th. So you'd have more areas that would be allowed by right, and you'd have, as Barry said, you'd still have the rebuild option where it's prohibited. That's slightly more liberal than today, where instead of being nonconforming, it would be the existing redevelopment of the existing drive-thrus would be allowed as an allowed use, which it could have the effect of allowing more gradual urbanization of those sites rather than some businesses, I think, hold on to their older building just because they don't want to lose the drive-through right, and this would allow that to be maintained and to scrape and rebuild but while still retaining that.
If I could just add one more bit to this, I think that I won't go through the details of this, but if folks are interested, we can go back through the details. But the green that's shown on this map east of 80th Avenue is a reduction in the amount of land area that would be available for drive-through developments. When we did do the zoning map.
Compared to today.
There's more, if you will, acreage in the general commercial, which allows the drive-throughs, and neighborhood commercial too right now than there is shown in this map. So there's a reduction overall, and the green areas that are shown on this map were looked at and analyzed along with the rest of the zoning in citywide with the Planning and Sustainability Commission. There was a lot of testimony about, or I'm sorry, not testimony, but a lot of comment to staff about where CE zoning is appropriate, and this is the result of that.
Yeah. So the third option, and just to dip back into the testimony to remind you, you did get a variety of testimony about this from folks who do business that relates to drive-thrus, and one group of testimony was from the quick vehicle servicing and gas station owners. An example was Space Age Fuel had a concern. Another group of testimony was more from the restaurant and existing drive-through businesses or grocery stores that want to maybe add a drive-through or a gas station. So this third option was developed to sort of partly to address this question of, well, what is special about 80th as the cutoff? So the option C would remove that cutoff and just say that drive-throughs are new drive-throughs are prohibited in all of those mixed-use zones. East or west of 80th, but the distinction would be that we would decouple the quick vehicle servicing from the other drive-thrus, and that those would continue to be allowed new in the green areas in the CE zone, while the non-quick vehicle servicing ones would be the ones that were subject to the prohibition. The other change that this would have the effect of doing is this would apply the more liberal rebuild allowance to all those zones, with the exception of the center's overlay and the central city, where you still would be nonconforming if you had one.
I have a couple of questions. First, in the Hollywood Fred Meyer, there's a place where you can drive to pick up groceries. And so it's not technically a drive-through, but older adults can drive their car there, and the groceries are delivered to their car.
Right.
How would that be treated under these options?
We have done some code work to clarify where the boundary between that activity and a drive-through is. So we've defined what constitutes an allowed sort of what's called click and collect, if you order online and collect your grocery or something like that. And there's a continuum ranging from something that's just a short-term parking space where you can drive up and let them know you're there and they come out, from that to more of a drive-through-like facility where there's queuing lanes, and we've defined it based on that physical difference. So we would allow the click and collect if it didn't kind of look like a drive-through, but and we've defined in code where that boundary would be.
So does that include pharmacy drive-through pickup?
The traditional pharmacy pickup with the drive-through window and the queuing lane would be a drive-through in the more traditional sense. There are versions of that that wouldn't qualify as a drive-through if it was just a short-term parking space with a button, or if you just was dedicated parking for pickup. That's different.
That was my second question, and I guess is there an argument to treat drugstores differently, particularly based on the profile of who might be going there to pick up a prescription, the physical condition, and particularly the benefit to an older adult who maybe is coming from a hospital or a doctor and needs to pick up a prescription, not to have to get out of the car, navigate a drugstore. By the way, drugstores in my neighborhood now look like grocery stores. They have nominally a drug business, and mostly they sell junk food. But is there a different way of approaching that issue, particularly around older adults?
You know, you have that ability. In general, the zoning code does not have a detailed list of uses like that. It's more performance-based, but you know, in a particular situation like that, you can name something and give it an exception.
And the third just comment I wanted to get your feedback, it piggybacks off something Dan said. I read somewhere or heard somewhere in the last year that Burgerville has morphed into something more than just a hamburger, you know, fast food franchise. That really Burgerville's business is now real estate. And it's because they acquired very desirable land throughout the city, put up their restaurants, and at some point the market conditions are going to be so changed that they're going to develop those sites. And they may have a Burgerville on the ground floor, or they may find another location. But the value of the dirt is going to make running a hamburger franchise, as compared to running their food business versus developing, market conditions are going to change that equation pretty dramatically. We know that when Fred Meyer was acquired, the new company came in and promptly sold the underlying land and then had the various grocery stores lease it back. So these businesses are acutely aware of the value of land. So I guess the question is, what's the harm in the interim of someone, a Burgerville, buying some dirt in East Portland, putting a drive-through in, particularly if we can anticipate when the market changes that the value of the land is going to make that business less attractive, and so they'll likely sell it?
I don't want to try to paraphrase exactly what the co-chair Andre Ba and others were saying, but in general, they were saying that they've been told for decades that you're not ready, to develop your land, you're not ready to have these kinds of schools, you're not ready to get a park yet, and they were just feeling like they were trying to make a statement also about we want the kind of development that the best neighborhoods in Portland are already getting. And so don't set up different sets of rules for us because we're in East Portland. So I think that just became a part of the... Well, and that's... So that's why we have option C to look at how to make that their intent be citywide.
Say for the record, I may have the least ideological view of this issue. I mean, I don't go to fast food restaurants. In fact, I just came back from Chicago, and it was almost impossible to get from one terminal to another because the McDonald's lines were so long and cumbersome. And so obviously all of our messages about healthy eating are falling on deaf ears. But I don't use these places generally that have drive-thrus, and yet we are in effect establishing a new set of rules for East Portland. And I appreciate the point you just made. I have to figure out where does government and the market come together to make good policy, and I'm still not convinced we found the right spot. I'd like to see the option C mapped out in something bigger than that. So maybe we could get a larger version of that, and maybe a walkthrough on what option C does. Because I'm intrigued.
Yeah, if I can just throw in an additional dimension that I want to bring to this debate is with respect to East of 80th. You know, franchises are one of the best opportunities for minority entrepreneurs to be successful. And in a city that talks the talk about helping small businesses and helping minority businesses in particular to be successful, I think we're, you know, the community development argument seems to be totally bypassing that fact. And so I'd like to at least flag that as one of my concerns, is we are denying minority entrepreneurs the chance to run successful businesses. Now, you can run an independent restaurant, but your chances of failure within the first 2 years are probably 90%. And that's not true when you're owning a franchise.
So I think it would be helpful to flesh out option C a bit more. I think it's closer to the mark. I mean, I was attentive to and interested in the question. I mean, even though obviously I believe we should be zoning for the future we want rather than to simply facilitate the present or the past, we're going to need gas stations for a while yet. And to have gas stations get swept up in an attempt to have a good retail street. Wait a minute. That seemed to me impractical. So I appreciate the carve out of, hey, if you're still doing vehicle servicing, that's not a drive through in the way that a restaurant or pharmacy or one of these other drive throughs is. So I like that piece of it. I was not particularly persuaded by the treat Eastport one differently argument. So I like that aspect of option C as well. Whatever we're doing citywide. So, you know, I think you're headed in a direction I like with the compromise proposal. Still, obviously, issues to discuss among us about whether that does get it right or not, but I think it's closer to the mark for me. This to us with those maps, with particularly the options in that.
Actually, Mayor, one addendum. The PSC had an amendment requiring drive-thrus to serve bicyclists and pedestrians, and the city attorney's office and my staff are looking at whether that requirement works in the zoning code or should it be handled elsewhere. I think it's an interesting concept. We're not sure that it belongs in the zoning code. We're talking to Catherine Beaumont about that.
One final reminder about drive-thrus is that they are still allowed also in the employment and industrial zones, with the caveat that those zones, generally all commercial, is a little bit more restricted in size in those zones. But you do have the ability to do drive-thrus in those zones as well. And those are primarily in the Columbia corridors where that zoning exists. So... are we ready to shift to the Alphabet District then? Okay. So the Alphabet District, as you know, is the historic Alphabet District. It's a National Historic District. We sort of backed our way into this discussion. The reason we were fussing with floor area ratios in the RH zone is because through the comp plan, you had changed some of the boundaries of the RH zone, and in the zoning code, there are maps that define what the floor area ratios are for all portions of the RH zone, and because you changed the boundaries of that zone, we had to go in and do housekeeping on those maps. And when we did that, we attracted the attention of testimony from various historic districts who were concerned about floor area shown on those maps. So originally, a big chunk of the Alphabet District is on a map that allows 4-to-1 floor area for that area. Through testimony at the Planning Commission, they were persuaded to change a portion of that map to, in both Irvington and in the Alphabet District, to 2-to-1. And Tom, could you just describe the maps and our process for thinking that through?
Yeah. Go to the next one.
There you go.
That's the buildable land inventory analysis that we did as sites that are likely to are either vacant or likely to redevelop in the area. And so this is the slide up there and at the bottom of your page is a zoomed in area of the Alphabet District that was recommended by the Planning Commission to go to 2-to-1. It's between 21st Avenue and basically I-405 and north of Cooch Park and MLC, the Metropolitan Learning Center. The black dots on the map are the contributing structures in the historic district, and the blue shading is the relative existing development based on FAR. So the light blue is less than 2-to-1 FAR, The medium blue is 2:1 to 4:1 FAR, and the dark blue is greater than 4:1 FAR. The cross-hatching is the recommended area to go from 4:1 to 2:1 FAR. And the red highlights are the three buildings, two of which you've received testimony, the two smaller ones on your right. The furthest one to the right is the Buck Prager building. The one across the street from that is a church that submitted a letter saying that they were interested in developing part of their site for affordable housing. The other one up to the left, the dark blue, is actually a relatively new development that came through in, I believe, 2012. It's actually at 4.7:1 that they achieved through a combination of bonuses and historic transfers.
So it's already developed.
It's already developed, so we could change that as part of the 4:1 map back. There are sort of two options, two approaches, especially when it comes to the sites that might have affordable housing development. And if we could go to the next slide, here's an air photo of those sites. The one on the right is the Buck Prager building. One option would be to keep the south end of that site, which has the historic structure on it, at 2:1, and do the north half, which does not have a contributing structure, at 4:1. That would give them sort of the mix additional density that may satisfy their plans. They would still have to go through historic review by the Landmarks Commission to make sure that building that met or utilizes most of that 4:1 FAR is still compatible with the historic guidelines for the district. The other option is to keep it 2:1. As Eric mentioned previously, as part of the inclusionary housing program, we're still trying to figure out what to do with inclusionary housing bonuses in historic districts. Right now, RH at 2:1 is proposed to get a half FAR for inclusionary housing as a bonus, so that would take them to 2.5. They could get more through a historic transfer off of another landmark that has additional FAR that could be transferred, that could get them more, and that could be something done in conjunction with working with the neighborhood and you know, finding property owners who aren't going to develop their historic landmark site to get them the density that they need. The other option is if the housing proponents, especially on the Buck Prager site, come through, and you know, the effective date of this is not until at least January of 2018, while we go through the LCDC acknowledgement process, they can file a development permit next year. They can file a development permit today and get the 4:1 and go through that process. It still winds up in Landmarks Commission to determine compatibility. The other option is, if they can't meet that timeline and it is 2:1 and the bonuses and transfers don't work, they could still file a Measure 49 claim and get back to the 4:1 zoning through a Measure 49 claim process later. So there's a bunch of different avenues that can eventually get them the density they need to do affordable housing on the site. It just depends on what's the starting point. Are they at 2:1 and trying to work their way up, or are they at 4:1 and in Landmarks arguing compatibility and having Landmarks push it down in the name of historic compatibility?
So have the Landmarks Commission and the Design Commission weighed in on this issue?
Landmarks Commission originally weighed in on the entire 2:1 as a good move. I think you heard testimony about truth in zoning and And you know, that's a constant struggle tension with developments that they review, and so they generally like the agreed with the direction of going to 2-to-1. Not in this particular case.
Right, because I know for both.
In general, yes.
And how about the Design Review Commission?